Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Yes, weekend programming. You can tell because the fans are working, because the air conditioning isn't. Please give, won't you? I know they've digitized the record library. Why don't they digitize the air conditioning? Hey, there's an idea. Hey, what are you trying to pull? Ladies and gentlemen, young adults experience news fatigue. Oh, the poor kids. From being inundated by facts and updates, and they have trouble accessing in-depth stories. This is according to a new study unveiled this week. That must have been fun to unveil the story. Must have been fun to veil it first. And then to unveil it. The research project commissioned by the Associated Press way back in 2007 analyzed the news consumption patterns of an ethnically diverse group of men, 18 men and women, all of 18, AP, spring for 35 next time, will you? 18 people are in this survey, but they're ethnically diverse, and they range between the ages of 18 and 34. The money pot! It ultimately helped AP design a new model for news delivery to meet the needs of young adults who are driving the shift from conventional media to the digital platform. The kids can't find the in-depth stuff, ladies and gentlemen. Any ideas? Speaking of in-depth and digging, the Energy Department's safety plan for handling containers of radioactive waste before they're buried at the Yucca Mountain dump has become a fool's errand. Not according to me, not according to nuclear critics, according to a major nuclear equipment supplier. Under current plans, the casks... That makes it sound almost pleasant, doesn't it? The casks. They're aged. Aged nuclear waste. Awaiting burial at Yucca Mountain could be sent into a, quote, chaotic melee of bouncing and rolling juggernauts in an earthquake. That's according to Holtec International, one of the nation's largest manufacturers of nuclear waste storage systems. Got some nuke waste on your hands? Call Holtec. The blistering critique of safety standards is in a newsletter that Holtec sent to its customers and suppliers, warning that the project has become a, quote, doomed undertaking, unquote. I like both of those words. Together, geez, undertaking. Ah, Holtec supplies storage casks, to power plants around the country. Nevada officials say the harsh comments deepened their concerns about the siting of the dump at Yucca Mountain. It shows a lack of attention to safety, says Nevada's Agency for Nuclear Projects director. An Energy Department spokesman said he had not seen Holtec's critique and had no immediate response. The Energy Department applied just this very week for a license to build Yucca Mountain. 70,000 metric tons of waste will eventually be sent by truck and rail to the dump. Once the waste arrives, it'll have to cool down for years before being placed in deep tunnels. The Energy Department wants the material to cool down in casks, according to Holtec, without adequate seismic anchors or other restraints. The government last month rejected a proposal from Holtec for a temporary storage system underground that the company says would maintain safety in the event of earthquakes and airplane crashes. Well, those never happen. It instead chose the government two lower bidders who proposed unanchored systems. Holtec intends to develop the below-ground system at its own cost. The government expects Yucca Mountain to experience earthquakes that produce ground movement comparable to a magnitude 6.5. In such a quake, according to Holtec's newsletter, quote, pigs will fly before the cask stays put, unquote. Some good deals on property in that area, I think, are available now. In case you're looking for a place in the desert near some nuclear waste. And, ladies and gentlemen, Hillary Clinton's campaign has been suspended. As you know, she had a big event, a rally to announce that she lost, basically to endorse the winner. Well, basically to remind people as often as possible that she'd gotten, so she says, 18 million votes. By the way, just for perspective, 18 million is the number of people who will be getting no TV when the digital changeover occurs next year, according to the latest estimates. Just, you know. And there's been much debate about whether, well, the Clinton campaign at various times has complained of sexist treatment by the media and others, I guess, and the setting off the greatest debate in America. You know, it's the nothing is more American, nothing is more heartily, wonderfully American than arguing over who's been screwed worse. No, me. No, me. I'm more of a victim. No, me. So, sexism versus racism. The debate continues. And just a statistic to put into consideration. According to Human Rights Watch, the United States has 2.3 million people behind bars, more than any other country, more than ever before in its history. The highest incarceration rate in the world, 762 per 100,000, compared with 152 in Britain, 108 in Canada, and 91 in France. There's a sharp racial imbalance in the U.S. prison population, blacks outnumbering whites by 6-1. Blacks are 12 times more likely to be jailed for drug crimes than whites, although drug use is about the same in the two races. No information about women. See? Sexism. Hello, welcome to the show.
spend eternity in the city. Let the carbon and monoxide choke my thoughts away. And pretty bodies help dissolve our memories. They can never be what she was to me. She's gone.
She's gone.
Oh, I better learn how to face.
She's gone.
She's gone. Oh, I better double to replace her. And she's gone.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show, the hottest place in Santa Monica, ladies and gentlemen, the Le Show Dome, where the air conditioning never works this time of year, especially on weekends. Weekends are different. Ladies and gentlemen, with Hillary Clinton out of the race, really? The mantle, of course, the mantle of presumptive nominee falls on Barack Obama. And here's my guess. The campaign is going to boil down to one question. Is he an American or an exotic? If he's an exotic, of course, that means he's a radical. He doesn't like this place. He loses. If he's an American, he loves this country. He's one of us. His story is our story. He wins. Just watch. There are going to be commercials for Barack Obama that make Ronald Reagan look like a subversive. I'm just telling you, he's going to be more American than Chevy if his people are on it. And if not, President McCain. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. Watch the other hand is the lesson of this week's selection of items from news media here and overseas that you probably have not been apprised of when you're like the kids, you know? The U.S. is holding hostage some $50 billion of Iraq's money in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This is according to the Independent newspaper of London. The purpose, to pressure the Iraqi government into signing an agreement seen by many Iraqis as prolonging the U.S. occupation indefinitely. U.S. negotiators are using the existence of $20 billion in outstanding court judgments against Iraq to pressure their Iraqi counterparts into accepting the terms of the deal. The deal, by the way, the U.S. has put a late July deadline, on Iraq signing the deal. Iraq's foreign reserves are currently protected by a presidential order giving them immunity from judicial attachment, but the U.S. side in the talks has suggested that if the U.N. mandate is not replaced by the new agreement, Iraq's funds would lose this immunity. The cost would be the immediate loss of $20 billion. The U.S. is able to threaten Iraq with the loss of 40% of its foreign exchange reserves because Iraq's independence is still limited by the legacy of U.S. sanctions. U.N. sanctions. The threat by the American side underlines the personal commitment of President Bush to pushing the new pact through, here we are, by July 31st. Although it is in reality a treaty between Iraq and the U.S., the president is describing it as an alliance, so he does not have to submit it for approval to the U.S. Senate. Iraqi critics of the new agreement say it means Iraq will be a client state in which the U.S. will keep more than 50 military bases. American forces will be able to carry out arrests of Iraqi citizens and conduct military campaigns without consultation with the Iraqi government, and American soldiers and contractors will enjoy legal immunity in Iraq. The U.S. had previously denied it wanted permanent bases in Iraq, but American negotiators argued that so long as there is an Iraqi perimeter fence, even if it is manned by only one Iraqi soldier around a U.S. installation in Iraq and not the U.S. is in charge. The U.S. is not even willing to tell the government at Baghdad what American forces are entering or leaving Iraq, apparently because it fears the government will inform the Iranians, according to an Iraqi source. And speaking of which, President Maliki is in Iraq. No, sorry. He is in Iran. President Maliki of Iraq is in Iran for talks with the Iranians. Again, they just came to Iraq a couple months ago. Close ties, you think? And on a related story, from McClatchy newspapers in Washington, Defense Department counterintelligence investigators suspect that Iranian exiles who provided dubious intelligence on Iraq and Iran to a small group of Pentagon officials might have been, quote, used as agents of a foreign intelligence service to reach into and influence the highest levels of the U.S. government. That's all. That's according to the Senate Intelligence Committee's long-awaited Phase 2 report. A top aide to then-Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld shut down the 2003 investigation into the Pentagon officials' activities after only a month, and the Defense Department's top brass never followed up on the investigator's recommendation for a more thorough look-see. The revelation raises questions about whether Iran may have used a small cabal of officials in the Pentagon and in the vice president's office to feed bogus intelligence on Iraq and Iran to senior policymakers in the Bush administration who were eager to oust Saddam Hussein. Iran was a mortal enemy of Hussein after the bloody 8-year war. The aborted counterintelligence investigation probed some Pentagon officials' contracts with Iranian exile Manuhar Gobarnafar, whom the CIA had labeled a fabricator back in 1984, right about the time he was involved in the Iran-Contra affair. The Iran-Contra affair, where the United States sold missiles to Iran. Same government. Those contracts were brokered by an American civilian. The contacts with Gobarnafar were brokered by an American civilian, Michael Ledeen, a former Pentagon and National Security Council consultant and a leading advocate of invading Iraq. According to the Senate report, the Pentagon's Counterintelligence Field Activity Unit concluded in 2003 that Ledeen was unwitting of any counterintelligence issues. But the unit said that Ledeen's association with Gobarnafar was widely known, and therefore it should be presumed other foreign intelligence services, including those of Iran, would know. And by the way, the man who represented Ahmad Chalabi, the guy who sold the war to the United States by feeding Iraqi dissidents with bad information to the United States intelligence services, the man who represented him in Washington, taking him around, getting his media profile raised, Charles Black, now the director of the McCain campaign. More news from outside the bubble, also from McClatchy newspapers. The presumptive Republican nominee for president and now the Democratic nomination as well are exaggerating what's known about Iran's nuclear program as a duel over how best to deal with Tehran. McCain and Obama say that Iran is developing nuclear weapons. The U.S. intelligence community, however, thinks Iran halted the effort to build nuclear warheads in mid-2003, and the IAEA has found no evidence to date of an active Iran nuclear weapons project. The candidate's comments, says McClatchy newspapers, actually Jonathan Landay, who was right about everything in the pre-Iraq period, raise questions about how carefully the two have studied the public record on what's become a major campaign issue. The issue is also significant because the Bush administration inflated assessments of the Iraqi nuclear threat as it sought up to whip up public support for war. From the Guardian newspaper in London, the United States is operating floating prisons to house those arrested in its war on terror, according to human rights lawyers who claim there has been an attempt to conceal the numbers and whereabouts of detainees. Details of ships where detainees have been held and sites allegedly being used in countries across the world have been compiled as the debate over detention without trial intensifies. The U.S. government was this week urged to list the names and whereabouts of all those detained. Information about the operation of prison ships has emerged through a number of sources, including statements from the U.S. military, the Council of Europe, and the testimonies of prisoners. The analysis also claims there have been more than 200 new cases of extraordinary rendition since 2006, when President Bush declared that the practice had stopped. Well, by stopped, he didn't mean ended. It is the use of ships to detain prisoners, however, that is raising fresh concern and demands for inquiries in Britain and the U.S. According to research carried out by a human rights organization, Reprieve, the U.S. may have used as many as 17 ships as floating prisons since 2001. Detainees are interrogated aboard the vessels, of course, outside the legal purview of any nation, including our own, and then rendered to other often undisclosed locations. Syria, anyone? From Agence France-Presse, Dateline Sydney, all the arguments Australia used to justify sending troops to fight in Iraq proved to be wrong, according to Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, as he fulfilled his election vow to bring the soldiers home. Rudd, who ousted long-term Conservative leader John Howard last year, was fiercely critical of the process that took Australia to war. Howard had presented four reasons for joining the coalition, Rudd said. He then clinically listed and dismissed each of the arguments. Have further terrorist attacks been prevented? No, they have not been, as the victims of the Madrid train bombing will attest. Has any evidence of a link between weapons of mass destruction and the former Iraqi regime and terrorists been found? No. Have the actions of rogue states like Iran been moderated? No. After 5 years, has the humanitarian crisis in Iraq been removed? No, it has not, unquote, Kevin Rudd. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Speaking of the Senate Intelligence Committee and its Phase 2 report, you might have heard about it. You might not have. Last time I checked, well, it was on the front page of Friday's New York Times. It was in the Washington Post. It was on, according to NPR's database, it was on one of their flagship news broadcasts, but not the other. Hey, so much news going on. And the kids, you know, they need their headlines. Anyway, in case you missed it, phase one of the Senate Intelligence Committee report came out a few years ago when the committee was Republican-dominated, and it basically said that the intelligence agencies had been wrong. The committee then promised phase two, in which it would analyze how the administration utilized or, question mark, misutilized, close question mark, we can't do that in English, the intelligence it had. And that phase two has been delayed repeatedly till this week. So here are some of the findings of the bipartisan, that is to say, all the Democrats and two of the Republicans members of the Intelligence Committee. Now, in fairness, the other Republicans criticized this report for leaving out all the times that Democrats, like John Kerry, had said untrue things about Iraq in the run-up to the war. But they, last time I looked, they weren't running the government. Anyway, here are the highlights from the Phase 2 investigation. Statements and implications by the President and Secretary of State suggesting that Iraq and al-Qaeda had a partnership or that Iraq had provided al-Qaeda with weapons training were not substantiated by the intelligence. Statements by the President and the Vice President indicating that Saddam Hussein was prepared to give weapons of mass destruction to terrorist groups for attacks against the United States were contradicted by available intelligence. Statements by President Bush and Vice President Cheney regarding the post-war situation in Iraq in terms of the political, security, and economic did not reflect the concerns and uncertainties expressed by the intelligence. Statements by the President and Vice President prior to the October 2002 National Intelligence Estimate regarding Iraq's chemical weapons production, capability, and activities did not reflect the intelligence community's uncertainty as to whether such production was ongoing. The Secretary of Defense's statement that the Iraqi government operated underground WMD facilities that were not vulnerable to conventional airstrikes because they were deeply buried was not substantiated by available intelligence. And the intelligence community did not confirm that Mohammed Atta met an Iraqi intelligence officer in Prague in 2001, as the vice president repeatedly claimed. So added to the list compiled last winter by the Center for Public Integrity, which enumerated 935 lies told by the administration top officials in the pre-war period, we can now add 936. The assertion that, quote, the CIA made us do it.
A think tank did the counting. The numbers still could rise. Total what we were told before the war. 935 lies, 935 falsehoods told by our leading guys. Eyes of steel, tongues of fork, 935 lies. What a day, it'll take you 3 years to eat up 1,000 pies. But in a year and a half, we swallowed whole 935 lies. To the skies, but somehow it's not quite as scary as 935 lies. $1,000 will buy you a pretty good suite at the Ritz, truffle dinner, plenty champagne, a custom-made soup that fits. Yeah, $1,000 will buy you a pretty nice day. The gift that keeps on giving, thanks to 935 lies. 935 falsehoods told by our leading guys. Eyes of steel, tongues of fork, 935 lies.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is What Up, Dog? What Up, Dog? CPR's new news blogazine for the young and the newsless. Thanks for multitasking us into your day. I'm Cody Outscoop. In today's Check It, Dude file, science. Not weird science or bad science, or science that she blinded you with.
Science!
But science. There are debates about science all around us these days. Global warming, stem cell research, endangered species, you know the drill. Up to now, the debates have been among scientists, lobbyists, and lawmakers. Today's guest wants to enlarge that list and perhaps broaden the debate. Quentin Charlatang is the executive director of the People's Science Initiative, and he's in the crib with us today. Quentin, welcome.
Thank you. It's hip in here.
Said. Exactly where does the People's Science Initiative fit into all these controversies I was referring to?
And many others.
Cool.
Well, we just feel, and by the way, I mean a lot of common sense folks that I talk to in the course of my job at the Common Sense Folks Foundation, we feel that the scientific conversation is being monopolized, you might say, by the people who happen to have advanced degrees. Hmm. You know, there's an old saying, Cody, war is too important to be left to the military. We feel science is too important to be left to the scientists. We know how wrong the so-called experts have been in our primary elections this year. Why should we trust them when it comes to the, I don't know, the age of the universe?
Well, there are those who will say that scientific knowledge isn't about trust, it's about evidence.
Cody, all due respect to them. But here's the deal. If evidence was so powerful, O.J. would be in jail.
Word. So what exactly does your organization want to do to shake things up?
We don't think it's shaking things up so much as leveling the playing field and giving the guy who keeps his nose clean and plays by the rules a seat at the table.
That's just like a metaphorical table. There isn't a real table in this scenario.
That's correct. But we believe the American people should have a voice and a vote about these issues that involve life and death, and sometimes life and death.
These would be the so-called life and death issues?
Yes, sir. The legislation we propose would require that any scientific issue that involves the spending of taxpayers' money, either to fix it or mitigate it, must be put to a vote of the people.
No, it would come up on the ballot at, the next congressional election?
We're letting the Congress people hammer out the details. But yeah, that strikes me as the kind of detail they would, in this case, want to hammer in. Mm-hmm. There'd be, of course, a robust and vigorous debate, as kind we've had in the recent primary. Scientists would, of course, be in the mix, but so would affected parties, hardworking businessmen, ranchers, farmers, fisher people.
In other words, the whole gamut.
That's right, the whole gamut.
This would be, as you envision, a televised debate or 30-second spots or...
Or anything in between. Hmm. I think on these questions, Cody, the free market of ideas has been a little bit like a niche gourmet specialty shop, and we want to turn it into a big box superstore of ideas. And instead of these issues being settled behind closed doors at some panel or conference or deposition, they'd be settled out in the bright sunlight of democratic decision-making. I mean, who could be against that? I'll tell you who couldn't be against it is common sense folks.
You say this is in the form of legislation. Is it currently before, like, Congress?
There's a bill that has been introduced in the Senate by Republican James Imhoff and Democrat Joe Lieberman. We're trying to raise public awareness of and interest in the principle of public participation in these issues that so strongly impact on, who else, the public. Seems only fair to me, Cody, but hey, you know, sue me. I'm just kind of a common sense guy.
Quentin Charlatang, thanks for hanging with us this AM on What Up Dog.
Good to be in the mix.
PM in some areas. Tomorrow's just a few mouse clicks away, and that's when we are back with another posting of What Up Dog. Our thanks to the whole CPR News posse, and to the John and Melinda Fry Foundation. Fry is fly. Till the next one, I'm Cody Outscoop. Peace out. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. First, from Telephony Online, trade magazine for the telephone industry, the three-screen advantage. I'll read it for you. I'll be the one reading it for you. That's how you can tell it's me, in case there's any confusion. The cell phone, highly personal and seemingly always at hand, is inching closer to becoming a sought-after platform for advertisers. While cell phones don't rival the internet or television and ad presence, mobile advertisers can work with those screens in a complementary fashion to produce an integrated, ubiquitous marketing approach. To understand the true potential of cell phone ads in a multi-platform environment, mobile content provider IO Global Incorporated is in the midst of testing integrated mobile, PC, and TV marketing measurement practices. The goal of the effort, dubbed the three-screen trial, is to gather metrics on the role of mobile handsets in a multi-platform environment. While wireless handsets will be the primary focus of the study, a guiding principle of the research is that they're not understood in isolation. Quote, we think it's strategically important test for mobile phone marketers, but we also think it's a very important strategic test for marketers in general, says Bob DeSena, Managing Director, North America, IO Global. Mobile is the largest and fastest growing of the communication channels, but it's the least established. We have a complex task. How do we quickly assimilate advanced measures and advanced knowledge of this new channel for marketers? That's what he's mean to say there. He didn't say for marketers. He means marketers. The rest of us know how to use it. In the trial conducted with media companies and advertisers, response to branded content delivered on both mobile and PC platforms will be correlated with TV viewing data. Ad campaigns launched during the trial will integrate mobile marketing tactics, including cell phone banner ads, pre-roll, post-roll, and in-stream videos, as well as short message service and pure content sponsorship. The trial is supported by the Mobile Marketing Association, which recently released its first installment of mobile advertising guidelines aimed at providing a global ad framework for the wireless phone industry. Those guidelines are not rules, but rather guiding principles put in place to allow and enable creativity, says Bob Walczak, CEO of ad serving company Ringleader Digital. Of the three-screen trial, Walczak says, quote, I'm a full believer in integrated advertising. Whatever direction they're heading, I think it's positive, unquote. And from Advertising Age, what popcorn prices mean for movies. Suddenly in Hollywood and movie theaters across the nation, corn really is a four-letter word. Thanks to the inflating cost of popcorn, the price of movie tickets is expected to skyrocket by as much as 30% this year. According to Richard Gill, a University of Santa Cruz economist who studies the business, you're going to see a $1 to $2 increase in the price of a movie ticket, he says, and that's being conservative. According to an Agricultural Department report, next year's corn stocks are expected to plunge to a 13-year low, and as a result, corn futures contracts have soared to an all-time high. This can be attributed to the demand for ethanol, which will claim 40% of next year's crop. Munching away at the margins of movie theaters that rely on popcorn and other concession sales for as much as nearly half of their revenue. They're going to lose some of their customers, Mr. Gill said. Some of them are just not going to go to the movies. Well, but the movies are still so damn good. That's me talking. Ticket sales have been insulated for the past 30 years from both inflation and recession. That's in part because consumers sought relief from financial foes and the woes in the dark of the cinema, but because roughly 25% of the price of admission is subsidized by popcorn, soda, and candy sales. Says Mike Campbell, CEO of Regal Entertainment, the nation's largest theater chain, if we didn't charge as much for concessions as we did, the tickets to the movies would cost $20. This year's popcorn crop is down roughly 10%. In past 18 months, the cost of coconut oil used for popping corn has risen 24%. Hey, coconut oil, that's got to be good for you. And the price of the paper pulp to produce popcorn tubs has jumped 40%. Well, that's not because of ethanol. Oh, who knows? Who knows what's because of ethanol? Archer Daniels Midland knows, which is why they sponsor every news broadcast you ever hear or see. Oh, but that's me ad-libbing. A bad habit. When my job is to read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Guarantee that She's a small town girl who I worked until she entered the fold. Now she won't get fat, you know, she won't grow old, but she's alright. Yes, she's okay. She's living for the moment. As long as she looks good today, then she's alright. Yes, she's okay. She's got her couple of thousand puts away to help Mother Nature, yeah. Don't you know we're all crazy?
We're all crazy.
That's what we are. We're all crazy.
That's what we are.
So put some cow in my face, Mother. Just don't leave some scars on me. We're all crazy. That's what we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, this week's big mystery was the unannounced and secret meeting between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton after he clinched the number of delegates and she almost conceded. There was, of course, that firestorm of controversy about her not conceding, not endorsing, earlier in the week on Tuesday night. So there was a meeting that developed, and of course the cable news people jumped all over it, went to Hillary's house, where they were told the meeting was going to be, and of course it wasn't at Hillary's house. It turned out to be at Senator Dianne Feinstein's house. Senator Obama and Senator Clinton met in secret for a while, emerged smiling, some say laughing. Really, that's all we know. The rest is up to the imagination.
So, Senator Feinstein has, you know, quite a splendid house.
I think she may have gone a little overboard on the striped upholstery, but yes, it's very nice.
Of course, I wouldn't know about those things, striped upholstery and all that. That's kind of Michelle's department.
Mm-hmm. Because she's a woman.
No. Because. That's the kind of thing she's interested in. I mean, I don't like basketball because I'm a man. I just happen to like basketball. A lot of men don't.
We were going to do up the Chappaqua house in something like this style. A little more rustic, of course.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But that was before I loaned my campaign $14 million.
I thought it was $11
million. Well, for public consumption, it was.
Got it. You know, for that matter, Michelle likes basketball, too.
Oh, I'm sure she does. I'm sure I could like it if I spent the time to learn it.
It's, you know, it's kind of like a Mac. You know, it's not that hard to learn.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Well, this, as you can imagine, is a kind of a black day for me. I don't mean that in any way.
Don't worry.
Obviously, I just meant that I'm in a dark mood. Let's say a grim mood, a disappointed mood.
You're grieving over your loss. Oprah and I talk about that a lot.
Do me one favor, please, Senator. Don't feel my pain.
Okay. Her husband's business is what again?
Whose?
Senator Feinstein's. He's in real estate or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, I just want to say, you know, you ran a great campaign. You made me a better candidate.
Yeah. If all that I and my 18 million supporters accomplished was to make you a better candidate, we're happy. You know, that's good enough for me and my 18 million voters.
You really hit 18 million?
Mm-hmm. For public consumption.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you asked each of them to send you a dollar, you could retire your debt and have 4 million left over.
Senator, I know you're a very smart man, but if you can figure out a way to get my people to give me a dollar each so I can go buy my home furnishing fabrics in Milan like Dianne Feinstein does, well, sir, I'll really endorse you.
Okay. So, as I understand it, the, you know, theatrics of this thing call for us to leave this meeting smiling.
Smiling. Mm-hmm. That's the thing you do with your teeth.
Yeah, that's right.
I'll work on that.
So, horse goes into a bar, bartender says, why the long face?
Do you see her remote?
I got it.
Thank you. She must have something funny on her TiVo.
2 hours later.
So yeah, I would have thought Al Roker could dance.
Why? Because he's
thin? No, because he's
good meeting, folks.
Fine meeting.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Hey, guess who's sorry this week? Him, Al Franken. Franken has apologized for offending anybody with his 2000 essay in Playboy. The essay entitled Pornorama was hammered by state Republicans who charged that Franken had no respect for women or family values in light of the piece's series of dirty jokes. Their condemnations were then followed by Democrats and the state Planned Parenthood, many of whom saw it as a political liability. Quote, I'm proud of my career as a satirist, which doesn't mean every joke I've ever told was funny or indeed appropriate, Franken said in a statement. I understand and regret that people have been legitimately offended by some of the things I've written. So he's sorry. Organizers of the Beijing Olympics have said sorry for a manual deemed derogatory to athletes with disabilities. The now withdrawn English version said they, athletes with disabilities, could be stubborn, unsocial, or oversensitive, especially if described as, quote, crippled, unquote. The organizers' detailed do's and don'ts document is entitled A Guide to Chinese Law for Foreigners Coming to, Leaving, or Staying in China During the Olympics. Dateline Pittsburgh. Hello, Pittsburgh. A former Carnegie Museum of Art guard charged with vandalizing a $1.2 million painting simply snapped due to life's normal pressures, including impending fatherhood, his defense attorney said. Timur Serebrikov is an immigrant from Azerbaijan. His fiancée is about to give birth soon. Concern about his life and future caused him to use a key to slash the painting Night Sky 2 by Latvian artist Vija Chelmins. He apologized and confessed, telling police he simply didn't like the painting. Other people who snapped: Bill Clinton has apologized for lashing out at a quote, slimy reporter who questioned his lifestyle and his effect on wife Hillary's now-ended presidential campaign. The former president reacted to an article in Vanity Fair in which journalist Todd Purdom analyzed Clinton's personality and moral standards. The president says he's a really dishonest reporter. I haven't read the article. There's five or six blatant lies in there, which he knows from not having read it. But he's a real slimy guy. Reminded that Purdom is married to his former press secretary, Dee Dee Myers, Clinton said, "That's all right, he's still a scumbag." The spokesman apologized for the comment, saying that President Clinton was understandably upset, but the language was inappropriate and he wishes he had not used it. Jeffrey Toobin has emailed to the National Review saying, "I just saw a post about my New Yorker piece about Roger Stone and the earlier articles about him in the Weekly Standard. As I read the post, the gist of the complaint against me is not plagiarism, but discourtesy. That is, it would have been appropriate for me to offer a hat tip or shout out to Matt Labash's earlier work. On balance, I think it's right. I should have acknowledged Matt's articles, which I did read and enjoy a great deal, so let me take this opportunity to apologize to Matt and the Weekly Standard." The father of a Clayton County, Georgia biology teacher charged with threatening a student apologized to the community for his son's actions, saying the teacher was stressed out. "We're all snapping, ladies and gentlemen. We all snapping." Travis Corey Hextall was arrested this week on disorderly conduct and terrorist threat charges for telling an unruly student he would, quote, "rip your eyeballs out," unquote. His father is a state representative, Joe Hextall. Hextall attended his son's arraignment hearing. "He's apologized. He's remorseful," says the elder Hextall. "He loves those kids and took them goodies all during the year. He would love to go back to teaching when this is all over." He said his son was allegedly threatened by the male student all year and he didn't feel safe in the classroom. Also in the world of school apologies, Pennsylvania ran into more than a slight glitch when it came to its annual high school yearbook. It appears the computer's autocorrect was on when officials with a printing company ran the text through its system before publishing the final book. That's led to some rather embarrassing changes to the names of the kids forever memorialized now. Max Zupanovic is now listed as Max Supernova, and Kathy Carbaugh became Kathy Airbag. And then there's Alessandra Ippolito, who will have to explain why she was known as Alexandria Impolite in high school. The publisher admits it's at fault for the gaffes, which were found on at least four of the 176 pages. It intends to make up for the error by issuing free stickers with the real names that can be pasted over the wrong ones. The company says it's sorry, but that these things are a frequent occurrence in the computer age. It happens all the time, every year, says Ed Patrick of Taylor Publishing. Which reminds me, ladies and gentlemen, when I was looking, no need to tell you why, but I was looking for a synonym for the word pantload. You know, writers do this. And I went to thesaurus.com, and they had no synonyms for the word pantload, but just this response. "Did you mean landlord?" The Catholic priest who mocked Hillary Clinton in a sermon has been placed on leave from his Chicago, Illinois parish. Michael Flager was asked to step back from his obligations, although he disagreed with the decision. He has apologized to Hillary Clinton again, most recently during a phone conversation in which they discussed meeting once the primary campaign is over, which could be like now. An MIT student has apologized for causing a bomb scare at Logan Airport by wearing a blinking circuit board attached to her sweatshirt. Star Simpson. Now that's a name for the ages, isn't it? Apologized in a statement released through her attorney, saying she never intended to cause harm or alarm. Bet she intended to get noticed. Dateline Seattle. A lesbian has complained that an usher at Safeco Field asked her to stop kissing her date because it was making another fan uncomfortable. Sabrina Guerrero and her date were approached in the third inning by an usher who told them their kissing was inappropriate. A Mariners director of guest services says, according to Guerrero, had apologized to her, The team spokeswoman could not immediately confirm that. A TV company in New Zealand that promoted a new program with a derogatory slogan about Jews has apologized. The company has dismantled its billboards in two cities promoting the show Mad Men, The Glory Years of Advertising, which bore the slogan, "Advertising agency seeks clients, all business considered, even from Jews." Spokesman Tony O'Brien says the billboards were removed on Wednesday following complaints by the Jewish community. An apology would run in the next issue of Time magazine in New Zealand. "We take full responsibility for this and have totally apologized to the Jewish community," the spokesman said. "This campaign crossed the line." Golf Digest magazine has apologized to the Sikh community for publishing a doctored image of Guru Arjan Dev holding a golf club. And finally, Dick Cheney, yes, same one, has apologized. "No, not for that. No, not for that. No, not for that." He has apologized for what his spokeswoman called an inappropriate attempt at humor that implied that inbreeding is common among West Virginians during a question and answer session at the National Press Club. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And despite all we know and all they know, and the fact that my CD machine has stopped, interesting, FEMA now plans to use trailers, again, in the case of a new disaster this hurricane season. That came out this week. Only the head of FEMA could approve the use of such trailers, and they would have to meet the agency's standards for low formaldehyde levels. That would be a treat. I guess the CD machine couldn't take the heat in here. And that concludes this week's edition of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations. Over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, or up and down the east coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz. Around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network on Mighty 104 in Berlin, on Sirius and XM satellite radio, on the internets at two different locations on your computer, live and archived whenever you want it, harryshearer.com and kcrw.com, available as a free download to members of www.audible.com/LeShow, and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like air conditioning for Master Control if you'd agree to be with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast and the playlists of these broadcasts, normally available at harryshearer.com, along with information on the forthcoming record, Songs of the Bushmen. You heard one cut from it on today's show. Bet you didn't know that. Well, some of you knew that. Hey, we're all snapping. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.